Get ready for the Ocelli effect.
I'm a big fan of the show.
Chuck Ocelli, and he's been known for many years as a blind JFK researcher specializing in intelligence agency involvement in multiple assassination, propaganda, and other global criminal operations in the 20th and 21st centuries.
Your listeners are extremely fortunate to have you, and everybody at AFR I know loves you, man.
We should learn from our relatively recent history, my brother. That's where I'm coming from. I say all power to the people.
And now, the most underrated voice in all media. The alternative, Chuck Ocelli.
So it is the 21st day of July 2016, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar that nobody ever bothers to question. And this is the Ocelli Effect, broadcast live on American Freedom Radio at AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Anyway, you know, we have gathered here together on a few occasions, not only at AFR, but on other networks. We have continued a series, okay, called the JFK Assassination Myths Series. Tonight we are doing episode 9, okay. This, believe it or not, there have been 8 previous episodes, and we're already talking about episode 10, by the by. So, what is it all about? In case you haven't heard it before, we have sat here and we have discussed the poorly founded, the really ridiculous theories, the mythos, as it were. I mean, I think it's worth it, and I know we've sort of done this before, but let's do it one more time so we understand exactly what we're talking about. Oh, and by the way, just so you know, before I get to who I have on the panel tonight, because as you guys know, I mean, it is Thursday, so you can expect Carmine Savastano, but you never know who else might be here with us today. And guess what else? You can be with us if you want to be at 218-339-8525. The call-in number again is 218-339-8525. And I am in control of the board. I will simply announce your area code and bring you in. So 218-339-8525. Anyway, back to the subject at hand. The thing is this. A lot of us have spent a great deal of our resources, our energies, our years, in fact, some of us decades, researching the assassination of our 35th president, John F. Kennedy. We have seen over the years many very bad theories, some people call them, but we have decided on the term myth. Why? Well, let's look at the etymology of the word myth very quickly. Okay, 1830 from the French, myth, okay, and I hope I'm doing that correctly, and directly from modern Latin, mythos, from the Greek mythos, speech, thought, story, myth. Is anything delivered by word of mouth of unknown origin? Now, unknown origin in this case means unknown bona fides, if you will, as far as evidentiary standards go. And there it is. A further look into the etymology states that myths are stories about divine beings. In some cases, people do, assign divine characteristics to characters in the assassination story itself, but believe me, it's all applicable here. Anyway, back to it. Stories about divine beings generally arranged in a coherent system. Now, they may not always be a coherent system when it comes to JFK, but I digress once more. They are revered as true and sacred. They are endorsed by rulers and priests. Well, rulers and priests, maybe not rulers all the time, but they are definitely seemingly religiously endorsed by individuals who put a lot of faith in a story without seeking evidence. Anyway, back to it. And closely linked to religion, as I just said. Once the link is broken and the actors in the story are not regarded as gods, but as human beings or human heroes, giants or fairies, it is no longer a myth, but a folktale. I almost think we should start the folktale section here, Carmine. when the central actor is divine, but the story is trivial, the result is religious legend, not myth. But anyway, this is the way these things can evolve, and what are we making an effort to do but to, well, stagger, stymie, actually completely arrest the evolution of the myths as they stand, and they are evolving in the interwebs out there on the in the realm of cyberspace, certainly in the realm of literature proper, in the realm of people's discussions, I mean, so on and so forth, all sorts of media being produced around a lot of nonsense, which is poorly founded, and once again, the origin of the facts. Not really very clear or, quite honestly, even realistic, Carmine. What do you think?
It seems to generally cover it, yeah. I think that our goal with the series that, you know, since it began, when we talked, when it was you, me, Trish, and Zach for the first time, and we sat down and we talked about, you know, over Skype what we wanted to get done with it, and it is to prevent any of these myths from taking up any more time, that if we're going to get to an answer, or at least some of the important answers in this case, things need to be taken off the table that have sat there for far too long, that don't have any evidence to prove them, and they've just been shouting for decades about something that can't be proven.
Right, and they take on lives of their own. I mean, after all, we've talked about the conglomeration. Here we go. You know we're not going to make it through a myths episode without mentioning one of the great orchestrators of the myth, which, by the way, we use the word myth in some cases here to avoid using the word fraud. However, I am very comfortable with, personally, no one else on the panel needs to utilize this, and I will take the legal risk of using the word fraud when it comes to someone named Judith Baker. And why will I do that? Because I dare her to try and haul me into court and prove that her story has validity. I would love to see that tried in a court of law in any way. It would be worth the aggravation and the lawsuit. So you know what? I will apply the word fraud to her alone at the moment. Please take me to court, Judy. Okay. That's something you guys probably didn't expect me to say, and I don't expect anybody else on the panel to endorse it. But you did mention Trish and Zach, and guess what, folks? We actually have Trish Fleming and Zachary Gendro. Hopefully I'm pronouncing his name correctly because I usually screw it up. And we do have them back. They are the intrepid researchers who have done a lot of stuff out there regarding, well, some of the myths. They've done a lot of solid work. You know, Zach has an interesting background, somebody who seems to be very well attuned to handling photographic evidence in some cases. But also the two of them are pretty meticulous and have come up with angles on things that I never even thought of when examining this stuff some years ago. And really, I've been impressed with the both of them and was happy to kick off the series, which originally was just something I had in my mind. And I told Carmine, I said, you know what, I have to at some point just collect the myths together and do a show on it. And, of course, Carmine countered and said, no, we need to do a series of them. And that is what we have been doing now for over a year. We have been, from time to time, revisiting the assassination and trying to knock some of the myths out. But without any further ado, first of all, Zach, how are you doing tonight?
Oh, hey, Chuck. How are you? Doing great.
And, you know, I want you to make sure that you point people to your web presence out there, any research, anything that you're doing, and upcoming work, stuff like that. Point that out, if you could, for people.
Trish and I have a website. It's the Debunked blog. It's debunked.wordpress.com. And we're also working on a book that's scheduled to come out really soon. We're really thrilled about that as well.
Right. Well, actually, the two of you are working together. I mean, Trish also, you know, just in look, the two of you work in tandem in some cases, but the fact is that each of you individually are absolutely great assets, and I'm extremely proud to do a show with you guys. You know, Trish, yes, Debunked blog, that's for sure, and I see the two of you engaged also on the forums, on Facebook and all that. You know, Trish, I don't know if there's anything separate you want to point out here, but, you know, some other place that people can go to take a look at your work or any other points of interest for you, go right ahead. And also, how you doing tonight, Trish?
I'm doing really well, thanks. I definitely would like to recommend the Research Bureau on Facebook. Again, Charles Cliff has been overly supportive along with the other admins in that group. It's a great bunch of folks, and again, it's great to be able to bounce new ideas off people and not just keep regurgitating the same old information that has been looked over a million times and nothing new has come of it. So, again, I do really want to give a shout-out to everybody in the Research Bureau because they do one heck of a job working together.
Right. And, of course, you know, other people have been on this show, like Charles Cliff, like Rob Clark. I mean, you know, we've had Steve Rowe on here, although he is a low nut kind of guy. You know, pretty solid individual. I like having Steve on. And quite honestly, he brought me some of the most interesting stuff when it came to some other research that was vaguely connected to JFK, in my estimation, but brought out a whole new element onto my show. So big shout out to all those guys, actually, and all of those, you know who you are, that are friendly to what it is we do here. But kind of odd because, tell you the truth, there's a couple of Facebook groups that are out there that seem like they would embrace exactly what it is we do on these shows, and they don't. But, see, I don't know if it's just because, you know, Carmine has them blocked because Carmine is the master of...
No. Hey, I haven't blocked anyone in months.
Carmine, by the way, is the master of the social media block.
As you know, I only do it with, you know, if I don't instigate the block. It's just, you know, if you see someone do something. I think people should definitely use it more often. You'd be surprised how much better people act when they think that you could just go away if you wanted to.
Yeah, I guess so. But you know what it also does? It means that I cannot tag you in posts. Because then people go, how come your content's not showing up? It's probably because you're blocked from being able to see Carmine's name, so I can't tag
him. I mentioned that to you the other day. I'm like, you don't got to tag me. It's fine. You'll get more people that way.
Yeah, I mean, we were even talking about doing an event on Facebook for this, and next time we will, but because I just didn't simply have the time to do it right, but next time when we do Myths 10, we'll definitely, because that's a milestone in my estimation, we'll definitely do that, and I still won't be able to tag Carmine because so many people will be invited to an event that they cannot see. But anyway, all jokes aside, where shall we begin? We're not going to beat the dead horse that is Judy Baker tonight right away anyway. We'll begin actually with an area that has always interested me, and that is the rifle itself, the alleged murder weapon. Now, over the years, there's been a lot of speculation about this, okay? And people have made some assertions that, despite being maybe well-intentioned, they have been way off. I mean, people talk about how, you know, the weapon is a piece of crap, which for the most part is true. However, there are ways that the weapon can be handled and it would be useful and all that. Now, that's not saying that the weapon in question, the one that is, you know, allegedly in evidence at this point, that particular weapon I don't think is in very good shape. I've talked to plenty of people that have handled that one in particular, and they all seem to report the same kind of thing. I've handled a Mannlicher Carcano myself, and I got to tell you, it's not the desired weapon of choice. If I was looking to make sure that I did not miss, this would not be the damn thing I would use. But anyway, putting all that aside, and Japanese scope and so on and so forth, there's a problem with the chain of custody on this thing, that's for sure. There's a problem with the point from which it was provided because of shipping concerns and all this. And we've heard this talked about over and over again. Most famously, I would say Mark Lane first brought out the rifle as a serious issue. And a lot of other people have tagged on later regarding it. And it's kind of a wide open question. Now, to me, it's hard to prove, first of all, that Oswald was absolutely in receipt of this thing. But there's a lot more to the story. And for that, I turn it over to Zach and Trish at this point. And tell us what you got here regarding this, you know, this big bone of contention that, you know, the lone nut people claim is, well, that's his rifle, that's it. And, you know, some conspiracy advocates have gone a little overboard. So you tell me what you guys have.
All right, Chuck. Well, thanks. I guess I've spent a lot of time debating people both sides. And one of the things that people that consider Oswald to be the assassin, one of their main points is that they try to make is that the rifle was linked to Oswald. And I guess realistically, the only way you could really link the ownership to him, I mean, at least in terms of concrete evidence, would be the, like you said, the chain of custody with the paperwork and the shipping documents involved. But anyway, Oswald at the time had a post office box, and that's where the rifle was sent to. And at the time, you'd get a post office box, and they'd have you fill out a form, and it was a three-piece form. And on page three, there was the part that would basically denote who was able to pick up the mail at the box. And as students of the assassination probably know, it was linked to the name AJ or Al Keidel. And there's been a lot of contention about whether or not, you know, whether his name, the name Heidel, appeared on this form, which would have enabled someone with the, you know, Heidel ID or what have you to come pick up a package like a rifle. Like I said, it was basically on one part of the form. And, well, as it turns out, in the Warren Commission, that one page is missing, which has led to a lot of questions. But, you know, they called Harry Holmes, the postal inspector, on the stand during the Warren Commission. They evidently had some questions since they called him back a second time in July of 64 and had him answer some questions about the, you know, the legality and then the regulations regarding shipping weapons and picking it up at a P.O. box and whatnot. He basically went on the stand and said that the regulation was that the regulation was that it would be destroyed when the box was closed, which it was by Oswald. I believe it was in May. And basically, yeah, that form was to be chucked out when the box was closed up. And then that would have been the end of it. But if you go back and rewind about a week after the assassination, Harry Holmes gave an interview in the New York Times and basically said that it was his indication that the form said that there was nobody else's name on there, which kind of means to me that he had seen this form. Okay, so fast forward a little bit into June of 64, and the FBI prepared a report that was to address some issues brought up by early researcher Tom Buchanan. And they basically said in one of their issues they were addressing that they concurred that indeed on the postal form that Oswald had indicated that nobody else was to pick up mail. Now, this is interesting because in the Warren Commission, it says that according to the Postal Service and Harry Holmes, the inspector, that this page three would be the only place you could get this information. But, of course, now that page is missing. So this is kind of caused like a dilemma. So where did this page go, and did the FBI actually have it? So
and there's something else here, Zach.
Debating in my mind these. Go ahead.
Well, there's something else here too, Zach.
Yeah,
and there is a bit of confusion between whether we're looking at the documentation for the New Orleans post office box or the, you know, or the Texas post office box, right? A little problem there.
Well,
because
this is also, go ahead.
Yeah, this is the oddity, and I've heard this argued about, and quite honestly, I don't know what the difference would be. I know what the difference would be if somebody switched documents here, okay? But what I'm saying is I don't know how I can even begin to unravel which is which, because at one point on one of the forms, from what I understand, you know, he lists himself and Marina as being able to pick up mail from the box. And then in another version of the story, according to some interviews that were given, Heidel is listed. Right? But I don't think anybody's ever produced the documentation.
That part is correct.
Yeah. But nobody's ever produced the documentation.
Yes. The, go ahead.
You know, as far as I know.
The documentation
for
the – go ahead, Trish.
Part three was actually found for the New Orleans, and Holmes testified, you know, thank goodness we didn't throw this one out. So they do have the third document, which states exactly what you said, that Marina and A.J. Heidel were listed as occupants of the mailbox. The problem is the P.O. Box 2915 that was initially opened, there's a couple issues that I want to raise. First one is the address, the contact address he gave was for George DeMarchild's daughter's house, which, if I recall, it was Fairmont. Street. So what that indicates was the box was opened at some point when Marina potentially was staying at the Taylor's house. Going further with this, if a package was delivered under the name Heidel to this post office box, it's kind of strange because obviously a rifle would not fit into a P.O. box, so someone would have to go and get it at the counter with the cashier or whatever, which you'd like to think would produce identification when they came and got it. The next thing that's kind of troubling is Hostie testifies, James Hostie, the FBI agent, testifies that he went to the post office box, or excuse me, the post office, and that's how he got the address for the West Neely for the Oswalds. What I find odd is the time frame. Again, a suspected defector that the FBI is investigating, he's got a P.O. box that's never mentioned to him by the post office at that time. So I don't know who to really point the finger at dropping the ball, but at the end of the day, the FBI could have got information about this P.O. box as early as, you know, 6 months after they arrived in the U.S. So, again, it has to be questioned why it was never brought up that this defector is receiving stuff from Klein's Sporting Goods, potentially arriving. Keep in mind, Klein's was under investigation at that point. Why this was never brought up to the FBI at that time?
Especially when it was under someone else's name, as Trish said. And all that is important. But I think ultimately what this boils down to is all this indicates that the Warren Commission at some point between June and July of 64 decided to change their story, and this piece of evidence was destroyed because it's indicated that somebody had seen it in two different documents. So, I mean, I don't know what more to say about that. It seems like somewhere along the line, this document was ripped out and torn, and because they needed to change their story because it was determined that he hadn't had Heidel on the box.
Well, and that's the odd thing, because really, where does the rifle arrive? That's the first thing. The second thing is, okay, let's imagine, and I'm going to play devil's advocate for a moment here, that at a postal counter, somebody might accept, because generally they would have to leave a slip in a post office box for something that doesn't fit, and they would keep it, you know, back behind the counter somewhere, and you'd have to produce the slip that matches the item. That's what I imagine. So that might have been the way that there was no ID produced, because it's assumed that you could go get it the slip. Okay, go ahead.
Right, that's what Holmes testified to. The issue necessarily is not the fact that he was able to get the rifle. It's the fact that this indicates that the Warren Commission destroyed valuable evidence and also lied to cover it up.
Ah, so here we have...
That's par for the course.
Yeah, Carmine, speak to that, because
I want to add one more thing in, and the fact of the matter is this isn't a theory that came out about after the fact of the Warren Commission. This is actually all indicated within the language of the Warren Commission itself, and is indicated all in their own documentation, based on all of what they said themselves in that document, so... You know, this isn't some theory that came out afterwards. This is their own words.
Right. They memorialized this this little shell game, in my estimation, because I think they kind of convolute the issue here. Because the first thing is, you know, the New Orleans box and the box in Texas are unrelated to each other in certain ways. But if you don't have the documentation for one box, you can't substitute it for the other one because the gun only went to one place, you know. But I wonder what you have to say about this, Carmine, because here we go. You have clear evidence of tampering with the evidence.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, when you look at the case and you try to be as neutral as possible, which I hope everyone does, you'll see that the commission – this happened a lot of times, and it happened at all levels of the commission, not only the staff and the advocates that were there in court for them, but it happened with the members. You know, we had Alan Dulles, who pretty much covered up everything about the Castro plots, covered up everything about ZR Rifle, he was gone by then, so that was McCone too. But, you know, I mean, we had huge, important plots going on that had direct relation or at least peripheral involvement by people who could have had direct relation to the assassination, and no one says anything until most everyone connected is dead. so no one can actually be held accountable.
Right, and plus we don't get to even hear about the you know, the Castro plots and all this stuff until what? Rockefeller, you know, Pike.
Yeah, pieces in the Church Committee, and then finally the HSCA is what. And even that, you know, sometimes there's still, you know, as you know, we've all, a few of us have even found some things that, you know, just weren't making the rounds before because they were so buried within all of the other lists and not important information.
Well, that's the other thing is in a lot of cases there's
a
document.
If I may add something?
Sure, absolutely, Zach. Go ahead.
Oh, no, sorry, Chuck. Go ahead. I'll wait.
No, go right ahead. I'm looking for you to pick it up. Go.
I wanted to just reiterate the fact that it's interesting because this, I know that the Warren Commission is not always consistent, but this is an instance where it actually contradicts itself on something as crucial as evidence and the ownership of the rifle. And they were basically trapped in a lie, like, which I feel is really almost, if there's any domino that you could pluck to start the whole thing falling down, that would be a very good one to start with.
Yeah, absolutely. And here's the problem, you know, and we don't even get into the evidentiary chain regarding the handgun here, because that's a whole other problem. You know, right. You know, have you looked at that any, Zach?
Oh, I'm sorry. I get interrupted there. I got a little lag there. What did you say? I apologize.
No problem. I was saying, have you looked at the you know, the weapon that's allegedly used to kill Tippett, which was delivered separately? Have you looked at that as well? Because there are problems putting that into Oswald's ownership as well. And I think that at the very least, an objective person would have to say that you cannot make a strong case to put these things, well, in Oswald's personal arsenal, whatever that may be. Both weapons, I think, are in question as far as their, you know, their legitimate chain of custody.
Well, you know, one of my online allies here, Charles Cliff, was listening into the show, and he just sent in a message basically to me saying that it was in regards to the shipper of the weapon, Railway Express, but he says that Railway Express didn't deliver to P.O. boxes. So I guess if that, you know, I haven't looked into that, but I trust Charles's knowledge on this, and I find that to be very fascinating. I do need to look more into that tip up, but I've been focusing on the rifle lately.
Yeah, well, I make the same contention, by the way, Zach, that that here's the problem, that Railway Express, effectively, if you think of it in modern terms, it's like UPS, okay, in a way. And here's the deal. UPS does not deliver to post office boxes. It just doesn't. Okay, a lot of people that support the Oswald did it theory, and that is exactly how I describe it, the Oswald did it theory will tell you that, oh, no, it's no big deal. You know, they would have just held it there and all this other stuff. But that is not provable in my estimation. I mean, we take a look at the, you know, there is no allowance for this at the post office. There's no procedural basis for this in the records for Railway Express that I've ever seen, and it's very bizarre. It's like imagining that, once again, you know, UPS would go to your mailbox or would deliver at your post office box somewhere else. Now, maybe in today's language, you know, you could go to a UPS store and they have their own boxes. But once again, does postal mail go to the UPS box the same way? Well, maybe it can. But the thing is, that's because it's being subdivided from the address where the UPS store is. These independent postal companies did not have a procedure in place to deliver to post office boxes. So the idea that that thing was sent into a post office box via Railway Express makes no sense. It should have been returned because it was not deliverable. That's really the bottom line, and yet we're meant to understand that that's the way it's stuck. That's been one of my bones of contention for 20 years. You know, I absolutely agree with Charles, by the way, and do love you, Charles. I you know, if you want to join in, man, give us a call during the second hour, by the way. So
another thing I'd like to mention, Chuck, I can. I've been reviewing some of the FBI reports, and I'm just going to read you a quote, and then I'll give you the citation in a second when I get it to back to the front cover, but it's the FBI laboratory has examined this photograph, referring to the backyard photograph, of course, and has concluded that while the rifle in the photograph is similar in appearance to the assassination weapon, and while there are no apparent differences between them, there's insufficient detail to identify the rifle in the photograph as the assassination weapon. And that comes from, just bear with me here for a moment, it comes from the supplementary report from the FBI, January 13th, 1964.
Hmm. And just to be fair here, I think Steve Rowe is in our chat room at AmericanFreedomRadio.com. I think that's Steve Rowe because it says Steve, and it says almost exactly the same thing that Steve Rowe said to me when I brought this up regarding the Railway Express issue. I'll read it to you. Railway Express was located just south of Dealey Plaza. They would have dropped a message in the P.O. box for the recipient to pick up the package, nothing mysterious. I'd simply disagree because I've never seen it done with these independent shipping companies that this is the case. They don't do this to P.O. boxes. But, hey, you know what? It's still an open question in my estimation, and at the very least questionable. Okay, without even going right into the ballistics and everything else, I think it's questionable, and I think the ballistics are a mess as well. But anyway, another story, and I don't want to get down on that rabbit trail because I want to let you guys, you know, kind of close out the issue of the rifle here.
Well, I think that another point that we should kind of touch base on is the possibility of two rifles having the same serial number. Ted Hammond, who's done extensive research in this, and I'm hoping he'll call in later, and Zach and I myself have really done a lot of digging on this. And there's quite a bit of information indicating that several different plants in Italy had been making the Mannlicher Carcano and stamping it with the same serial numbers. So, again, it brings into question, you know, obviously there's a lot of dispute on whether or not there was one or two rifles and, you know, the bullet was linked to rifle C2766. However, when there's multiple rifles with that serial number, we have a hard time establishing which rifle exactly it was that the police had and were testing it against. And further note, you know, the firing pin, according to, I'm sorry, I can't think of his name right now, but the firing pin and the gun was corroded. It was rusty. So, again, they were even skeptical of test firing this rifle. But this is, again, reportedly the rifle that killed the president.
Yeah, and it's important to note that the vast majority of the Carcanos that came across to the United States through Italy had no identification markers on them, which meant that, and this is a quote from a gunsmith, is that it would have been extremely easy for anyone with a set of die numerals and letters to basically reproduce the numbers on the gun. And you could have had easily dozens of this same gun floating around and no one would know which is which. You could switch them around at any time.
And I've seen a photograph, actually, of another Mannlicher Carcano with exactly the same serial number on it, which is kind of interesting. These serial numbers appear to have been repeated, from what I understand. And not only were they manufactured in Italy, by the way, but they were also manufactured in Argentina, which – go ahead.
I just wanted to – I know a little bit about this part. Is people should also consider that the gun was a surplus weapon – World War II style, that one of the reasons some of the mistaken Japanese rifle things could have happened is there actually was a Japanese edition of the Carcano that was sold to the Japanese arms companies during World War II. Now, the surplus weapons that were sent over here were cut down in some instances to the 6.5, like the one Oswald got, and some of those actually blew up in their owners' faces. So you have to begin by assigning Oswald quite a bit of luck that he didn't get one of those, and then you have to, as Trish mentioned, you have the rusty firing pin that Frazier found. You have that all of the experts that were gathered for the Warren Commission, at least in their initial round of testing, could not repeat Oswald's shots except for one person. They said, though, that they would be able to repeat it with more practice. The problem is that there is no verifiable time that Oswald had firing practice.
Yeah, I mean, and there's a lot of weird things. And this weapon becomes an extreme, you know, a set of really a warren for rabbits instead of a rabbit trail, you know, instead of a rabbit hole to fall into. Because honestly, you know, they talk about assembling the rifle, and, well, although there were no tools discovered, you know, you could do it with a dime. And to my satisfaction, I've actually seen somebody attempt to do this. There was a gentleman who was one of the founding members of Dealey Plaza UK. I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but I've actually seen him do this, try and assemble this thing with a coin, and it does – you know, I dare you to try it out there, you the listener. Go get yourself a Mannlicher Carcano, disassemble it in any fashion that you think it would fit into a smaller package, and go ahead and try and assemble it with a dime. And then, by the way, try and fire it with any sort of accuracy, because the thing will not be sighted in properly. But, hey, you know, who's counting for realistic scenarios here? So I get lost on this whole thing, really, and I think the rifle is one of those wonderful keys that that makes the lone gunman really, really difficult for me to swallow, and always has been. Now, have there been many contentions made about the rifle that I think are overdramatic? You know, for instance, you know, a guy like Jesse Ventura trying to fire this thing from, you know, on television, most famously, right? You know, I don't think that that was a fair, you know, a fair showing of what the weapon would do. And of course, when you consider that James Fetzer was the guy handing him the weapon in the first place, you never know exactly how well taken care of that weapon was.
And you also have.
Go ahead.
Sorry. But you also have to keep in mind that Robert Blakey was supposed to test fire in 78 through the HSCA, and he actually wrote a statement. I don't have it in front of me right now, but in a nutshell, he claims that the gun was in such poor condition that they actually had an identical rifle, and they used that instead of using Oswald's rifle.
Yeah, which is really useless. You know, it's right. Amazing the poor condition this thing is in. And just like in the King assassination, the Game Master rifle is in bad condition as well. But who's counting? All right. But I mean, do we have anything else to add to the rifle and really what we should be looking at, as opposed to, like I said, these overly dramatic demonstrations?
Well, I'd like to add one final point to this, and that in my numerous discussions with people that think Oswald was a lone assassin, they claim that you can, A, link the rifle to Oswald, and you can link the ammunition or the fragments found in the car and amongst other things like, you know, Connolly's wrist and Kennedy's skull and such. You can link those fragments back to that particular rifle. So I would say, and that's one of the main you know, points that they try to make in proving Oswald's guilt. Well, okay, number one, this casts serious doubt that you can link that rifle to Oswald, particularly, especially the documentation and the fact that there could be more than one serial number or gun with the serial number. But also what's important to note, and you didn't want to get into ballistics, I hate to do this, but I'll bring this up for 1 second. According to Vincent Gein, who performed a neutron activation analysis on the fragments for the HSCA, he basically claims, and this is really important, that the fragments that he received were not the same ones that the FBI had. And this is on quote, on record in his testimony, was that they did not include, this is quoting, did not include any of the specific little pieces that the FBI had analyzed. And he says, according to Mr. Gear at the archives, these were the only bullet lead fragments in this case still present in the archives, which according to Vincent Gein, who's actually handled these and has scientific expertise, the fragments in the National Archives are not the ones that came from the Kennedy case. And I'd like to say that he outside afterwards, he had some comments, and this is what he said, and I think this is really interesting. This is a quote from him. Possibly they would take a bullet, take out a little few pieces, and put it in the container and say, this is what came out of Connolly's wrist. And naturally, if you compare it with 399, it will look like ellipses. I have no control over these things. So it's sounding like he's trying to explain that possibly we've all been duped and the bullet fragments have been replaced, and he has no control over these things. So I'd find it very hard to link, A, the rifle to Oswald, and B, the fragments to Oswald's rifle, when the fragments themselves have basically been chucked. I mean, how can you even give that any credibility at all at this point?
And to follow up with that, the bullet fragments, this is going back to the FBI report again, It says, several tiny fragments of lead were recovered from the president's head and the limousine, and one was recovered from Governor Connolly's arm. However, these fragments were too small for the FBI laboratory to effect an identification with any weapon. Examination of a limousine also disclosed that the windshield was cracked and that there was a dent in the area of the windshield chrome molding at the top near the center, which may have been caused by a bullet fragment. So again, they're confirming there. And then when you take it one step further, Warren Commission Exhibit 840, there's actually two pictures of it. One of them is from the Warren Commission, which shows three fragments of a bullet. And then there's another picture of Warren Commission Exhibit 840 in the National Archives that only show two fragments. So one of the fragments out of Warren Commission Exhibit 840 is missing.
Right, so technically all of them have been replaced, and according to the inventory, one of them is just flat-out missing anyways. So the chain of custody for these items is very suspicious and should not be relied upon.
Well, not only is the chain of custody questionable because they had an empty vial. That's in the documentation from the HSCA. One of the vials,
which is
allegedly claiming to contain a fragment, is actually completely empty. First of all, not even a sliver, not even the untestable.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Zach.
Right, Chuck. It was the vial containing the scrapings from the windshield.
Right.
Correct. And they were gone, first of all. Second of all, here's another little dirty, two dirty little secrets, by the way, that a lot of people have overlooked. And you guys probably know this, so I'm probably just telling the listener this. But first of all, neutron activation analysis is virtually useless. Not only that, but bullet lead analysis that they allegedly, came up with, also virtually useless. I mean, Stu Wexler, who's been a guest on this show many times, co-authored a paper destroying that exact supposition regarding bullet lead analysis. Next little dirty secret is this. When it comes to Vincent Gwynn, because you guys pronounce – I pronounce it Gwynn. You guys say Gine, whatever. We know who we're talking about. This is the guy who is trying to promote this process of neutron activation analysis because, after all, he was the proprietor of the only lab that could do it at the time. Now, interesting fact also, when they were comprising experts for the HSCA, when they were bringing in scientific consultants, et cetera, you know what one of the questions they asked was, guys, did you have anything to do with the Warren Commission? Vincent Gwynn, okay, on the record, basically said that he had nothing to do with the testing for the Warren Commission, which is a blatant lie. Okay, if my memory serves me correct here, because he was involved in the initial investigation as well, maybe in a different facet, whatever. But that was one of the things that they were asking these guys when they brought him in to testify. And Gwynn, just didn't cop to the fact that he was part of the Warren Commission investigation. But anyway, put all that aside. Okay, put aside the financial motivation that Gwynn might have had for entering into this. Put aside the fact that, the evidence is either missing or seemingly not identifiable with the fragments that had been handled previously, et cetera, et cetera. It seems to me as though we have junk science being done on evidence that we can't necessarily even claim is exactly the same evidence. What do you think of all that, Carmine?
Par for the course, like I said earlier. You got and those are just some examples. You've also got the autopsy camera that's missing. You've got the forensic evidence, slides that all vanished. You've got, we could go on and on. That's been consistently the exception in this case and two others, that for some reason the government cannot keep straight the evidence. Now, I understand it's been over half a century.
Go ahead, Zach.
Oh, sorry, Carmine.
That's okay.
Oh, yeah, just to add on to what Carmine said, I've basically been compiling a list of all the evidence that's been lost, missing, or altered, and I know it's far from complete, but I've already compiled 32 important items that most of them were just lost. I mean, how could that happen? I mean, realistically, how could this happen on the watch when you have a blue ribbon presidential, commission? And also the FBI, all the money they could want, how could this possibly happen and not be some kind of, I don't know, after the fact, at the very least, cover up for something.
Oh, and what's fascinating to me, too, is that not only do you have clearly missing evidence, but you also have the suggestion of other absent evidence, because from the testimony of various people, right, there are photographs that are not in the collection of the autopsy photographs that, you know, people that developed them claimed existed, people that took them claimed existed, people that were present claimed existed, and yet are non-existent at this point in time and have been since the 1970s when people were able to look at this, because they did allow that set of autopsy photos to be there at, you know, if you take a look at what happened with the HSCA, there was, what was the guy's name? Regis Blehut, who got himself in trouble, right, over the handling of the autopsy evidence that was supposed to be kept in a safe. And if you've never heard of that guy, take a look into that little sub-story there. Interesting enough, but fact is that even when we talk to the people who allegedly took them, developed them, were present at the event itself, we have photographs missing. I'm not saying that they've been altered, manufactured, it's a cartoon, it's J.D. Tippett, all that nonsense. No, I'm just telling you that there is this suggestion of much more evidence that is missing in one way or another, possibly. So I think there's two categories that you need to form there for your list, Zach. One is clearly missing evidence, and the suggestion of other missing evidence as well. What do you think?
That's a very good point, and I'd like to add that according to Floyd Reby, who was one of the photographers, he claims that there were 160 photographs that he took that used a certain kind of film called press pack film that are just flat out missing. 160 photographs.
Yeah, right. And how many do we have today actually in the – I forget what the number is of the autopsy photographs that are in evidence today. You know, we have the limited ones, which people have gotten to see, have been passed around on the internet from the Fox set, as they call them. You know, and I have an original set of those suckers. But truthfully, the American public has never seen them. But even what is claimed to be held, you know, under lock and key at the National Archives is only what, 30 some odd, I think, altogether.
Yeah, it's.
Definitely not 160.
Yeah, it's nowhere near, and that's even considering the fact that there is stereo sets of these things. You know, even if you take each one as an individual photograph, you're not going to reach anywhere near 100 of anything regarding these photographs. And again, I say that over the years, all sorts of individuals, from the doctors present to the photographers to people that developed them to people that claim to have developed them, et cetera, there's all sorts of images that have never, ever been seen by anybody again after they were created in one way or another. So fascinating stuff, and another example of who knows where the evidence actually disappeared to. And then again, you know, look, maybe it's just mass hypnosis here, and a lot of people have an understanding. Never mind, I don't want to go there. I'm just saying that this leads to a lot of other wild speculation, and that's not what we're doing tonight. So, again, to kind of close out on the rifle, what do you think? Have we hammered the facts of the rifle down enough, or do we got to do it more? We might have to do it more in a future show. But for tonight, what do you think, guys? Have we hit it?
Well, I think the bottom line is, you know, if we can't connect the murder weapon to the assassin, I mean, where does that leave us? I mean, you know, if I hate to bring up the legal aspect, but, you know, we have to, as a community, come to an agreement of what the standards are for research. You know, one of the things that really has always kept me interested is the legal aspect of the Kennedy assassination. And, you know, if you ever watch a documentary, it's on YouTube, it's called Operation Correction. And it was released by the ACLU back in, I believe it was 1960 or 61. But anyway, the point being is they explain the difference between a hearing versus an actual trial. And in a nutshell, what it is there's no cross-examination of witnesses. Anything can be said by the panel themselves or the witnesses. And again, no one is there to dispute it, especially for a man that's not there to defend himself. So you have to look at it as a legal railroading to a degree. And, you know, if a defense attorney had the opportunity to represent Lee in a court of law, I'm firmly in belief that this would cause reasonable doubt, you know. And again, if you remove the assassination weapon from the assassin, where does that leave us?
Well, it leaves us with nobody has ever been able to satisfactorily describe a motive. You know, opportunity, you can argue, was there. But you're taking the means out of his hands. Now you have two out of three of the main three components to convicting an individual absolutely kicked out from under them like a stool, you know.
That's one of the big issues, though.
Exactly.
With his death, they couldn't use criminal standards anymore. So they used civil standards, and that's why they were able to get the conviction that they got. Because the standards were lowered,
It's interesting you say that because, again, he was never legally convicted in a court of law amongst a jury of his peers.
No.
So therefore, you know, to a certain degree, you know, he's not, according to the legal sense, he's considered innocent until proven guilty. Well, he's never had his day in court. And I've looked into this trial bit with him being passed away. And in a nutshell, there's a law that's called the absentia law. And it was actually used last that I can recall was during the trial for the Max Ayer. I can't think of his name.
Andrew Luster.
Thank you. And basically, when he took off and went to Mexico before Doug Chapman tracked him down, they continued his case under this law. He was not around for his own appearances. And I'm not sure the fine-tuning of whether or not that law could contemplate 1963. I mean, he was murdered. So, again, it's just food for thought.
Well, yeah, and the bottom line is this, that in a strictly legal sense, quite honestly, this is still, as a matter of fact, an open homicide in the city of Dallas as we speak.
Right.
There is no statute of limitation
That's
on
right.
it. No one has been convicted, so therefore it is still an open case.
That's right.
Even on the side of the
right.
repository,
it's a cold
it says
case,
alleged.
Not a closed case.
Exactly. It's a cold case, not a closed case. Perfect. So, moving on from here, I think we definitely hit the rifle. We've definitely spiked part of this discussion. I think maybe Steve or somebody who thinks like him has come back into the chat room again and made a statement about Eddie Barker having gotten rifles or something and picked them up at Railway Express, and therefore that's provable. Okay, fine. I surrender on part of that fact, I guess, if that's the case. But again, Lee, you know, strictly speaking, something is still wrong here. Anyway, moving forward.
Right.
Moving forward, you know, what else should we address? What do you think, Carmine? You want to hit one of the documents that you have there?
Well, there's 12. I'll go as fast as I can.
Well, you know,
hopefully we can get through.
Well, let's go through one short one because we do have another hour. We've actually almost killed an hour here, and part of it's because I'm long-winded, and I apologize. But before we go to break, let's kick off one of the easiest to recognize things that we need to understand here. Carmine, go ahead. Carmine?
Can you hear me?
Now I do.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say three of the ones on Plumlee later are short, so.
Oh, yeah, we'll
those
do
will
those later.
Easily. So this one's quick. It's just a quick story about that I think has a little unspoken lesson to it. The Secret Service investigated a call made by Lieutenant Williams of La Habra, California Police Department. Williams reported that a Catholic priest from Our Lady of Guadalupe in La Habra told Sergeant Hitchcock of the La Habra Police Department that one of their students expressed prior knowledge of the assassination of President Kennedy. How many times have we heard that claim? That's me. The student is Stephen Cicero, a second grader, age 7. Stephen's teacher, yeah. Stephen's teacher, Mrs. Sterling, informed her class that President Kennedy had been shot, and Stephen raised his hand and erroneously claimed the president had been not shot but stabbed with a knife. He said his grandfather had called his mother that morning and told her that his son was going to stab the president. Mrs. Sterling reported this to Sister Superior, and she in turn called the priest. After brief investigations, Secret Service agents returned to the Cicero's home, and Stephen admitted to telling the teacher a story about the president. At first, he claimed not to remember what he said, but then he admitted that he made it all up to get attention from the class.
Well, that about sums it up right there.
Yeah. And to me, what I think the unspoken lesson of the episode is that even usually honest children with no appreciable reason other than attention would fabricate a story regarding a historic event.
Ooh.
So some adults who might do the same thing, not just for attention, fame, and financial reward, I think should be considered.
Absolutely. And, of course, we are doing JFK Myths, episode number 9 on the Ocelli Effect tonight. My co-host, Carmine Savastano, my very special guests, Trish Fleming and Zach Gendro. We will continue this discussion in the second hour, and who knows where it's going to go from here, folks, but I don't think we're going to top the second grader making up the story to get attention, because it does sound vaguely familiar, like what some adults do. But, hey, we'll strike on that later. In the next hour of the Ocelli Effect, stay tuned to American Freedom Radio. We'll be right back.
Welcome to the world's meeting place. American.
Practically narcotic.
Freedom.
Oh, yes. I like very much.
Radio.
You're an American institution.
American Freedom Radio.
Did you know there are 3 million edible food plants on Earth, and none have the nutritional value of the hemp plant? HempUSA.org offers you hemp protein powder. It does not contain chemicals or THC, is non-GMO, and is 100% gluten-free. Hemp protein powder burns fat, builds muscle, contains 53% protein, and feeds the body the nutrients it needs. Call 888-910-4367 and see what our powder, seeds, and oil can do for you. Only at HempUSA.org. HempUSA.org introduces 3 brand new detox formulations of microplant powder. Brain Fuel for depression, bipolar disorders, and stress. Total Care, anti-cancer agent that cleans the liver and organs and increases memory. Rejuvenate, invigorates and heals the body, mind, and spirit. These products are your alternative to pharmaceuticals. Call 888-910-4367 and like us on Facebook. We ship worldwide. Only at HempUSA.org.
People of dumb. You can say what you want about this country, and I love this place. I love the freedoms we used to have. I love it. I love that. You know? I love it when it didn't take catastrophe to get us to care for one another. I love the fact that we're on camera all the time from all angles. But you know what? You can say what you want about America. And I say I love this place. I wouldn't have it any other way. Wouldn't live in any other time in history in any other place. But say what you want about America, land of the free, home of the brave. We got some dumbass people floating around this country. Yeah. And this ain't just ranting and raving. This ain't just blowing off steam. I got a little evidence to support my claim. It just seems to me that only a really low IQ population could have taken this beautiful continent, this magnificent American landscape that we inherited. Well, actually, we stole it from the Mexicans and the Indians, but hey, it was nice when we stole it. It looked pretty good. It was pristine. Paradise. Have you seen it lately? Have you taken a good look at it lately? It's embarrassing. Only a nation of unenlightened half-wits could have taken this beautiful place and turned it into what it is today, a shopping mall. A big shopping mall. You know that? That's all you got. That's all you've got here, folks. Mile after mile of mall after mall. Many, many malls. Major malls and mini malls. They put the mini malls in between the major malls. And in between the mini malls, they put the mini marts. And in between the mini marts, you got the car lots, gas stations, muffler shops, laundromats, cheap hotels, fast food joints, strip clubs, and dirty bookstores. America the Beautiful. One big transcontinental commercial cesspool. And how do the people feel about all this? How do the people feel about living in a coast-to-coast shopping mall? Well, they think it's just dandy.
You're listening to AmericanFreedomRadio.com, the network who perseveres in delivering intelligent debate, constructive dialogue with true independence. The freedom to broadcast the truth is not free at all. So what is American Freedom Radio worth to you? The empowering information with fun, honest and pure integrity behind it provides an example to follow, friendships to flourish, with the moral altruism that pulls no punches. The hosts sacrifice and show remarkable discipline in their duty to deliver quality radio and service to the community with strength, wisdom, and loyalty. The founders of AFI wish to thank you personally for sharing your views and insights to make the best radio and alternative media. Now it's time for you to give something back and play a vital role in the future of America. Be as generous with us as we've been with you. Click on the donate banner at AmericanFreedomRadio.com or volunteer by emailing AmericanFreedomRadio@ymail.com. Vaccines, psychotropic drugs, and artillery batteries not included.
No rules, no rules, no taboo topics,
no taboo topics,
no fear of doom,
no fear of doom.
We are American Freedom Radio,
American Freedom Radio.
The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweighed the dangers which are cited to justify it. For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of election, on intimidation instead of free choice, on guerrillas by night instead of armies by day.
Everything we want to sit and write's in our midst, but we don't really give a fuck, that's the twist. Once you fall into the trap, it's a bit. Somebody took a bullet for your right to exist. When they slide that by you, they give you a rival, a rifle, your D.I. Joe. Hold on to your Bible, it's about survival. That is what a free
fight. Payday Monsanto playing us into the second hour of the Ocelli Effect. Of course, that begins with a clip of JFK speaking, and that it has been a wildly interpreted speech over the years, but I still think the sentiment is extremely pertinent, regardless of how it is one might take it. And of course, having spoken to Ted Sorensen, I do understand what he meant. But anyway, we'll leave that aside, and maybe for another myths one day that is just JFK myths and not JFK assassination myths, who knows. So tonight we are doing JFK Assassination Myths, Episode 9. Of course, Carmine Savastano is with me. Zachary Gendro, there we go, I'm tripping over his name. Zachary Gendro and Trish Fleming are with us as well. And this was originally sort of the four horsemen of the JFK Assassination Myth series. And it's really good to have them back. And, by the way, if you want to join into the discussion, you can do so at 218-339-8525. Once again, 218-339-8525. And I have control of the switchboard, so I will be the only one bringing you on the air. If you want to add in a question, a comment, speak your mind in any way, shape, or form this hour, we will add you in. Meanwhile, just getting one more housekeeping thing out of the way. Of course, the entire Myth series, not only the ones that have been heard at American Freedom Radio here, but also on other networks, are available at Ocelli.com, which is my website, and they are in their own section there. I do believe they're free and open to the public, and this episode will obviously be added to it, because and unfortunately, there will be an episode 10, by the way. So as we continue, I do want to kind of turn the floor over to Carmine Savastano. Once again, though, Ocelli.com, yeah, if you want to go there, check out what it is I'm doing and all that kind of stuff as well. The live show only originates at AmericanFreedomRadio.com, and there is a live AFR player at Ocelli.com, which I did forget to welcome those of you who might have just gone there to listen to the show tonight. We do appreciate you no matter how it is you encountered us, as per usual. But Carmine, you actually have a website as well, and I want to give you a chance to plug it, and I am part of it, actually. And yep. I forget to plug. I sometimes forget my own website, Carmine, and it's mylastname.com, so, you know, you got to excuse me. I forget to mention it. It does happen. But go ahead, Carmine. You know, first of all, you know, you're the author of Two Princes and a King, which is going into my Amazon store, which will be on my website shortly, and it'll be one of the books that I suggest people to read. But aside from Two Princes and a King, which is available on Amazon through Kindle or paperback, I believe it's printed on demand. But either way, that is available. But you do a lot more, don't you, Carmine?
Yes, Two Princes and a King, as you said, a concise review of three political assassinations is available on Amazon. You can find out any information about it and read my blog that I do at least one article a month and usually a couple evidentiary presentations. And also the Improbability Vault, where I try to capture any of the improbable stories around the case and throw them in there so people don't get tripped up on them, as we all have at times. You can find that all at tpaak.com, tpaak.com, and you can go to Neapolis Media Group, neamg.com, and that's where I have my work, Chuck's work, Trish and Zach's work. There's stuff, shows that Charles Cliff's been on, some of the regulars on The Other Chelly Effect, so you can see that all on neamg.com, and you can find the Lone Gunman podcast with Rob Clark there as well, best of for him and Chuck.
That's right. Let's not forget Rob Clark, who, you know, has been on many of these shows as well. But once again, people, we are dealing with the original Four Horsemen of the Assassination Myth series tonight, because Trish Fleming and Zach Regendro are with us. And it is great to have you guys, as per usual. Always love sitting down with people who understand that we need to dissect these things properly. And for more on that, let's turn it over to Carmine and see what else he's got, because I love the way you adhere to the documentation, despite the fact that they have made great many efforts to destroy a lot of it. Some of it has survived, and isn't it fascinating, Carmine?
Yeah, it is. Well, it's the conversation that you and I, and I'm sure that Zach and Trish and I and you have all discussed it as well, that they couldn't have destroyed and changed as much as some people try to claim. It's just an exercise in futility after a certain point. You can't control millions upon millions of documents, especially when you don't even know that any of them are going to get out to the public. There's no reason to destroy them then if you think that they'll be securely, you know, in a vault for 75 years and everyone connected will be dead, so it won't matter. So I think in rare instances, special occasions, things of great import, yes. And we can confirm. I mean, just in Oswald's 201 file alone, you know, we proved on Chuck's show 37 things were missing just from one volume of his 201 file, and there's 50-some volumes of it.
Right. So. And let's not forget the other convoluted ways that people sort of twist things in order to fit their mythological assumptions. You know, like when I bring up, and I recently went back through the show with Roger Stone I did, and people started calling in and asking questions about the JFK assassination, even though we were discussing the Clintons on the show, right? And kind of fascinating there. He's actually part of the opening clips now where he says he's a fan of the show. But anyway, Roger Stone, you know, who makes the assertion that basically, you know, the pivotal figure there is Lyndon Baines Johnson, when confronted with the concept that, you know, Johnson is recorded in telephone conversations making statements that make no sense if he has any idea what's going on, you know, even when you explain this to somebody, that there is a logical fallacy here, because, you know, if Johnson knew that Kennedy was the target of the action that day, why would he ask J. Edgar Hoover if any of those shots were intended for him? You know, things like that. Let's just throw that out there in general. You know, what do these people say to you when you say that to them? They generally will tell you, well, he was play acting because he knew at some point, you know, somebody was going to record this and it might be heard. And it's like those tapes were never intended to be heard by the public. They were never, I mean, there was no internet imagined. There was no discernible possibility that that stuff could have ever been distributed to the public or to anybody who would have been investigating anything. That is a bunch of nonsense, okay? And in the case of the files, where we see a lot of stuff that has been declassified over the years, internal documentations, memorandums, wires, cables in between different offices and things, there was no figment of anybody's imagination that this stuff was going to be perused by people like you and me decades later. Okay, so there's no false planting of documentation that could have been contemporaneous. If you say that things were manufactured after the fact, long after the fact, fine, then you have to prove to me that in some way they are not of the character of the time. Like, for instance, when people talk about these, you know, UFO documentations regarding Kennedy, and this, believe me, I'll end it on this right here and turn it back to you, Carmine. But when they make these assertions that Kennedy was going to kind of blow the whistle on aliens, and they have these documentations out there that say, look, here is a memo being written by Kennedy to some director and this and that and the thing. When you look at this thing, and you recognize that even the classification stamp on that sucker, okay, even the classification on it is not in the right format for the time. It is a completely, you know, fictitious document that is a forgery. Bottom line, that somebody manufactured after the fact for some agenda in order to create a buzz regarding the alien agenda, and that's all there is to it. Okay, that's what the bottom line is when you look at this document, and it's clearly something that was manufactured after the fact. Anyway, enough of that, and I do agree with the chatter who's saying that, you know, Roger Stone's entire theory should be debunked on this show. Well, hey, you know what?
Is that our next request?
I think that's our next request for Myths 10, Carmine, and we will do that. Anyway, moving back to it, Carmine, I again turn it back to you, but I think it was fair for me to insert what I just did. So go ahead.
Okay. So we have a couple quick ones to go through before we hit our first request, which was given in by – if you can, when you do a request, please try to – you know, I mean, if you want to be anonymous, I understand, but give your name if you want. And we always like to send out a little shout-out before we do the request.
Absolutely.
So this next document I like to call the Oswald in Morocco story, and it is another tale received attention from the CIA station chief in Rabat, Morocco, a story that Lee Harvey Oswald had visited Africa for an unknown purpose possibly related to the assassination of President Kennedy came up. And a representative of the CIA and the U.S. consulate official visited Dr. George Walter Fraser Anderson to confirm he was told by Miss Ellen Buckingham that she had observed Oswald in Tangier, Morocco. Anderson informed the investigators that it turned out to be someone else. Dr. Anderson also stated he may have influenced others to believe Oswald had visited Tangier based upon his repeating the prior hearsay account discussed. Officials additionally involved a local named Narun Kamalakar, an accountant who held a philosophical group discussion that a French journalist had prior stated Oswald attended this discussion. Kamalakar explained that the confusion was largely based on his liberal ideas and the misidentification of another attendee of his group discussions.
Yeah, fascinating. And you know what's interesting to me about this, Carmine, is that this leads to a discussion of a lot of sightings of Oswald in a lot of places. Okay, now why do I say that in such a general way? Well, those who seek to construct these myths, in my estimation, this is just my opinion. You guys, I'll let each of you speak to this if you want. But those that seek to bolster their own what should we call them? Story arcs, okay? Out there will seize upon these things regardless of the legitimacy of the evidence, regardless of what is being verified, simply because it was reported, it's part of the fact. Even if it was investigated, debunked, is completely illogical. They're placing Oswald in Tangiers when he was clearly sighted in New Orleans. You know, whatever. It doesn't matter. They'll seize upon it as a – I hate to use the term because it sounds like Professor McAdams when I say this, but fact is it's a factoid that they grasp, and they insert it to bolster their own story. See, he was reported in all these other countries. So how did he travel to all these other countries? Well, obviously the CIA was giving him the money to travel. He's a CIA agent. You know, this is the James Bond Oswald archetype that's out there. And people do that. And people do that to bolster their own nonsense. Okay? That's what happens with these kind of stories. And would you agree with me or disagree with me, Carmine?
Oh, no. Oh, I agree. It actually becomes, you know, as I'm sure many people can attest to once they start reading over some of the documents, a visual pattern. And it occurs on both sides. You see officials trying to, you know, gin up what they can as well, just like you have those members of the public that are trying to, for whatever reason, insert themselves into this case, try to gin up their own version of the events, and then take, like you said, a little piece here and there of truth and just surround it by a forest of myth.
Right. You know, they'll state he was reported here. They don't bother to tell you that it's, you know, completely ridiculous that he was reported there. I mean, I could tell you that Lee Harvey Oswald landed on the moon if you want. It doesn't mean that I have to prove it now simply since I reported that. You know, somebody might say, hey, Oswald was on the moon. So therefore, he was part of the Nessus, you know, the Nessus security that was going on, and therefore connected to the Nazis, and and who knows where we can spin it from there. And oh, I hope I didn't just give birth to something.
Or as I like to call it, James Fetzer's next podcast.
Nice, Zach. What do you think about that assertion, though, that people that, you know, pick up on these little slivers of the factoid turn around to bolster their own cases? I mean, isn't this something that we see? Well, on a daily basis, just about out of a lot of these, let's call them myth makers. What do you say?
Well, it's attractive for people that have theories, and then they get attached to them, and then they'll, like you're saying, just kind of take things without really, you know, putting them through the meat grinder to see if it's true or not. You know what I mean? The meat grinder being their own analysis and investigation. They just kind of accept it because it's handy and it explains a lot of things to them. And, you know, you get a little, like I said, personally attached, and anything's possible. I did want to, not to shift gears, but I wanted to bring up something that was interesting, and I read Carmine wanted to discuss that matter about the Moroccan sighting, and I wanted to bring up the other connection to Morocco that I had seen over the years, and it relates to, incidentally, another double, but it relates to a double of Marina, and it regards a Moroccan student named Mohamed Ragab, who met Marina, evidently, he claims, in 1961 in Moscow. And this was at a time when Marina was living in Minsk. And he was quite, you know, clear. He'd said he photographically identified her. He had all these details. It matched, like, that her father was dead and she was living with other relatives and stuff like that. But what strikes me as interesting about this, that a few months ago, there was a list of documents that are still classified that are held and have been withheld and are due to be released, you know, soon, hopefully. One of them, amongst the documents relating to Bissell and Sturgis and all kinds of other things, is a document about Mohamed Ragab. So still to this day, there's something that is determined to be classified about this guy's supposedly, you know, far-fetched story that he met Marina in Moscow, a double of Marina Prusikova. It's quite interesting. But that's my connection to Morocco, and I wanted to bring it up as it relates to a double as well.
Yeah, but once you start to get into the misrepresentations of possibilities, who knows where they go? After all, you know, somebody that claims to have run into Marina Oswald in certain cases in New Orleans because it's inconvenient to their particular story arc claims that they were impersonating Marina at certain points. But anyway, not to mention names. Back to
sure,
it, Carmine.
It's an interesting tidbit.
Yeah. No, it definitely is. It definitely is. But it's a lot of fragments, you know.
Well, it's the fact that there's still something classified there that the federal government feels cannot be shared about this story, about this phony Marina Oswald.
Well, this is true, but then again, when we saw declassifications coming out through the ARRB, there were multiple copies of newspaper articles that were in classified files and stuff like this, which was totally ridiculous, because they were just newspaper clippings, literally. That's what they were, you know, strange things like
that.
Well,
true enough, but this stuff has been gone over 4 or 5 times by now, and I'm pretty sure the stuff that's still classified, at the very least, has got to be something that's, I don't know what, I'm not going to assume, but there's his name on that list among Bissell and others.
Mm. Well, there you go, and it does lead to more speculation because, after all, you know, if Oswald is your lone assassin, I still believe in the contention. Why is even a single piece of paper being withheld, you know, 50-plus years after his death? And clearly we would have absolutely changed our procedures in a lot of ways regarding human intelligence, electronic intelligence. I don't think anything would be relevant from 1963 to now. And, you know, it seems wholly ridiculous that this stuff is still being held. But anyway, where do we go from there, Carmine?
Okay. Well, from Morocco, we return back to America.
Okay.
The next feasible myth was created by a series of official and public mistakes and reliance upon a biased source. This will be the third document in the ones that I sent you. It's a memo from FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover to the Director of Central Intelligence, McCone, that the Bureau's investigation reflected that Jack Ruby was in Cuba in 1959 and no other time. There was a claim that Ruby had gone in 1963 to Cuba. People were trying to allude that it was Castro, basically, or a Castro agent meeting with Ruby, and I suppose by some way trying to infer that Oswald was connected in some way. And basically, it was not just members of the public that were fueling it, but it was also officials. Hoover mentions a letter furnished to the Bureau that was sent to a Jose Antonio Juan, which claims Ruby visited Cuba during 1963. The memo requests the agency to develop any information possible about Ruby possessing contacts or being in Cuba during 1963. Now, this ends up going to the House Select Committee, and the agency initially responded to the Bureau that they had received a similar report, yet the report was reliant upon someone in the agency that had no information regarding the matter, and they asked the Bureau to – they basically kicked it back to the Bureau. They said that they had received a similar report, but they didn't believe the source, so they kicked it back to the Bureau, and eventually an agency employee it was the Inspector General, John H. Waller, states, the OLC, Office of Legal Counsel, on 2 August called Liebengood of Senator Baker's staff in response to the query concerning Jack Ruby's alleged trip to Cuba in 1962 or 63. Unfortunately, on the basis of inadequately researched information given to the OLC, the staff admitted to knowing only about an allegation of a 1963 trip to Cuba by Ruby that was passed out as propaganda by an anti-Castro group.
Right, and there was a lot of fun and games regarding this. There was many attempts to tie Oswald. I mean, hours after the assassination, there was speculation regarding this. And for that reason, I would say that a lot of people had motive to seek the evidence to fit that conclusion, right? You know, most famously, of course, over the weekend, we saw, you know, Wade answering that question about, well, gee, he was part of the Free Cuba movement or whatever. And of course, he was corrected by more than one voice if you listen very carefully to the audio. But one of those voices, allegedly having been Jack Ruby's, you know, regarding this, it's kind of an odd thing. And but at the end of the day, a lot of the speculation that has come out of this has been generated by nothing, effectively, because it was just allegations, you know, nothing solid to really hang your hat on. Correct, Carmine?
Yeah, I would add, too, that it's from both sides. You know, in this case, we had the staff of, you know, the agency's staff members just taking a rumor that was started by one of the illegal groups that they funded operating domestically and tried to pass that rumor off as the truth. That almost made it into the record. But luckily somebody at the agency went, hang on. I don't really see any evidence for that. So where are you getting that from?
Yeah, exactly.
Staff admitted later to knowing that it was an allegation. So.
Right. So moving forward, I think we have well, gee, we're almost into the Tosh Plumley area here.
Yep.
Go ahead.
Now, I just want to end this one, then we'll go into Plumley. Breckinridge, S.D. Breckinridge was a later successor to Waller as Inspector General, and he was Inspector General during the House Select Committee. Well, Breckinridge comments in this, because he got to see some of these papers, that as a relevant note on whether or not the agency was purposefully withholding the 1963 cable on Ruby's 1959 visit, We have been informed by the FOIA staff of numerous people and groups who provided copies of the information that included Bernard Fensterwald, Harold Weisberg, Mark Lane, The Washington Post, The Associated Press, Newsweek, and The LA Times. Waller continues, as I discussed with you, I think it would be useful for my staff, specifically Breckinridge, to get Madigan out here to describe him that our task force approach to the problem and otherwise convince him that we are cooperating with them to the fullest on this problem. We'll coordinate with OLC.
Right. So what does that mean, effectively?
Well, what I think it means is that Waller wants Breckinridge to lead the deception on the other officials on the HSCA, that they are complying with them, even though in this one instance we can prove that they're not. Mm. I think that happened more than once, definitely. You know, it probably happened quite a few times. But this is more overt as far as saying that we need to convince them that we're actually doing what we probably aren't.
Right. And, you know, when you take a look at some of the internal documentation from the HSCA, there's a bunch of what appears to be right hand not knowing what the left hand is doing, or the two hands shaking together and creating certain things that spin into other directions where it should not. It's kind of a fascinating mess, really, the HSCA in certain areas. Not everywhere. You know, in some cases they did some very valuable work. And you know, stuff like the Lopez report, I mean, I would say is definitely fascinating. But let's move on into something that I definitely want to strike, okay, while the iron is continuously being reheated. Mr. Plumlee, okay? Well, was he a CIA pilot? I'll accept that. Was he someone who has his ties to certain covert actions at certain points? Possibly. Was he somebody that might be a very fascinating figure in history, you know, despite sort of injecting himself into the Kennedy assassination? Maybe. But let's get to the reality of Tosh Plumlee, because a lot of people hold this guy up as someone who understood the inner workings at the time, was part of the abort team, you know, part of the James Files story, part of the Chauncey Holt story, part of the I was on the other side of Dealey Plaza and I watched Kennedy's head go backwards and while I was walking along these wooded areas and all this nonsense. Let's get down to the reality of Mr. Tosh Plumlee.
So I agree with your statement that it is possible that he was a member of the agency, that he was a pilot for them and all that other stuff. Later, mm-hmm. You know, there's supposedly Jim Mars and other people have claimed that there are cables that reveal that he was involved with the Iran-Contra scandal. And we don't have access to all those files, so I'm not going to make any claims about that. That's all possible. What I have found, I think, will lead you to believe, as I have been led to believe, it's highly unlikely and improbable that he worked for the CIA in 63. And if he did, he would have been of such a minor status, they never would have entrusted him. First of all, it wasn't any whole huge group that did this crime, because you can't get away with it if there's that many people doing it. It has to be a small compartmentalized group. And members of that group likely were killed off quickly afterwards to keep the number even smaller.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, an abort team right off the bat defies logic. You're adding more people that you don't need there when you could just call off the assassin. You don't need to send a group in a plane down to Dallas at the last minute to go in and stop your assassin. You call the assassin, you say, don't shoot him.
Right.
Much easier.
Even when you're looking at a military sniper team, the way that they act, they always have a signal to abort the mission among them, okay? And if it's a lone assassin, there's generally someone who is a controller who gives the final green light, let's just say, or if they don't receive the signal, like in other words, there may be something where if you get a phone call, it's a go, and if you don't get a phone call, do nothing, this kind of thing. Is often utilized when it comes to these operations. Usually there's a go signal, not a stop signal, to be honest with you. But even when they have a rolling sort of, you know, in motion, event, generally speaking, they would instruct the team, which is in place, by a certain signal that it's a no go. You know, that you abort the operation, not with a whole team of people that you abort it, but with the original controller, therefore, like you said, not expanding the scope of the individuals thusly involved in the plot. Okay, that's part of the logic. There's more to it than that, I think. But realistically speaking, I mean, just think about it from a common sense standpoint. Isn't it much better to have it so that there's either a go signal or there's a stop signal, and here you are, know what they are, and they may be something that has nothing to do with anything in the world, you know. A woman with a yellow dress will come out with an umbrella even when it's sunny out, something like that. Let's not get into umbrellas too much, but I'm just saying that's how you do it. Yeah.
There's much simpler ways to do it rather than adding multiple people on a last-minute plane trip, you know, because it has to sound like a spy novel, apparently. Mm-hmm. So, So, Plumlee, now, there's one gentleman that I know you can give us background on, because our Trish and Zach might know about him, but I know of him, and I know somewhat about him, but I think you know more, because he was around earlier in this, before I started to get involved. And the Plumlee story was first brought officially that I found, the earliest mention I found of it was at the AARB, and it was filmmaker and prior James Files myth proponent Bob Vernon.
That's right.
That attended a public hearing at the AARB and offered William Robert Tosh Plumlee. So if you want to tell them quickly about Vernon, I...
Well, Bob Vernon's an interesting guy. He was the one who originally had put together the presentation, which was meant to be shown on television, the Confession of the Assassin deal, the original interview of James Sutton / Files, you know, because his legal name is Sutton. He adopted the name Files, all that kind of stuff. But anyway, who was in prison and at Joliet at the time and all that. You know, when you see the younger tape of James Files and him having a much simpler kind of discussion about his facts regarding the assassination, it seems, this was the first videotaped interview. And Vernon was the guy who was really behind that, was there at the genesis, and later on sells it to our friend over there, Mr. Dankbar, I think that's how you pronounce it, Wim. Yep. Dankbar, later on sells it to him, and quite honestly, in not necessarily big public pronouncements, but I have understood in recent years that he has gone a little more public, or had gone a little more public with it, that after a while he had felt that he had been duped by the story. And look, a lot of us have made mistakes. I mean, I point out all the time that at one time I actually thought that the French gunman scenario was realistic, and you know, there was a reporter following up on that pretty extensively at the time, and it seemed like a possibility, you know, until you actually unravel the thing a little bit, and all of a sudden it falls apart. And I think that's what happened to Mr. Vernon, and he sold his concerns with Mr. Files over to Wim Dankbar, who has continued to perpetuate it regardless of whatever facts actually emerge to dispute all of it. But that's about what I got to say about Mr. Vernon. But that's true. He did attend one of the hearings, at least one of the hearings of the ARRB that was public. And at certain points, they did take input from various researchers, sometimes quite overtly and sometimes sort of under the table through various staffers. This happened quite often during the ARRB, which was not an investigation of any kind, but was meant to simply create the document dump that it did, although they sort of went to verify the legitimacy of certain documents and other pieces of evidence that were allegedly being collected and cataloged for the American people and are now part of the JFK records collection at Archives 2. So I think that's a fair assessment. You know, I don't know if Zach or Trish have anything to say on the subject.
Yeah, I would like to say that I'm not by any means a Tosh Plumlee expert, but I have done a little bit of looking into him, and I found that references dating back to 1959 of him referring to all kinds of crazy shenanigans involving, like, stolen and abandoned planes and things like that all over the Southwest. And on top of it, I guess what the pattern I noticed in reading these statements, I was looking at the pre-assassination stuff because that I found more interesting, because anybody can say they're involved after the fact. But he says he was involved, and if there's anything beforehand, you know, I was looking into that. But basically the conclusion that the FBI agents had was that he was the one coming forward with these, like, stories that nobody ever investigated him, according to the FBI agents. And it seemed to them like he was almost coming forward to draw attention to himself or something like he was involved with. So that makes me, you know, really curious about, well, what was that, yeah, he felt he had to say and why they didn't believe him.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And, you know, somebody points out in the chat room that the, you know, the whole Johnny Roselli story and all this other stuff from Plumlee is absolute nonsense. They're correct. Now, as to whether he could have at some point been tied to the CIA, I don't know. You know, I don't know. I would put it that way. I think that it's possible that he, based on certain information that has floated around, could have been involved at some point with something. Just, but I don't have anything.
Later.
Yeah. Well, first of all, we're talking the 1980s versus the 1960s.
Exactly.
And the other thing is, we also might just be talking about a pathological liar.
Well,
I'll
go on. So Plumlee prior testified before the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee later on in the 90s, I believe, and to the corporation propagating his claims, Truth, 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 Incorporated.
Nice.
Wow. Tell me that doesn't – that sets off a bell for me when you got to say it three times. Anyway.
Hurts my ears. Yeah, go ahead.
Plumlee testified that Johnny Roselli, known to have worked simultaneously for the CIA and the Mafia, was among his boarding passengers November 22, 1963, on his way to Dallas, Texas. He asserts he was part of a CIA abort team to prevent Kennedy's assassination. The late George West founded Truth, Inc., and while pursuing Plumlee's claims, was contacted about another unlikely claim in the person of James Files. Multiple proponents of this myth, including Judith Vary Baker, have adopted the abort team claim. Okay, so that's basically what I'm talking about as far as what the abort team is. It's based on Vernon's presentation of Plumlee's claims, and
right.
People have adopted it as well. So the next, I can go through this one real quick because Zach touched upon it a little bit. I think we probably found at least a document or two that were the same because I started looking for mention of Plumlee or an abort team, and there's an FBI interview in 59 that says, during the course of the above interview with Plumlee, it was noted that he told a very confusing, illogical story with a complete lack of specifics, and he has indicated that he has in the past used his imagination for the purpose of making his story more believable. That is, he has admitted to making up names of persons allegedly contacted by him.
So going
just,
all the way
little,
back
a little
there.
A little flavor from 59.
Yeah, a little flair for the dramatic and the dramatic and the fictional. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So Plumlee contacted the FBI. Another thing that I often find strange to people who say that they are working secretly for one of these organizations, that they're the ones reaching out to them rather than the organization. But, you know, that's another story. So Plumlee contacted the FBI regarding customs agents he believed were bribed in allowing contraband through, which is ironic since Plumlee himself was charged multiple times for the exact crimes alleged in service of the anti-Castro exile groups.
Yes.
He made these allegations while he was incarcerated for check forgery in Ohio. So from jail, he called the FBI. The reporting agent states Plumlee was vague in his allegations against the aforementioned individuals, stating they appeared to turn their backs while planes loaded with arms took off from the airport. It appeared that he is basing his statements in this regard upon hearsay, or he may possess additional information of a direct nature he would not divulge. Much of the information furnished by Plumlee was contradictory in nature, and there was obvious discrepancies in the dates and places mentioned. Because of admissions made by Plumlee in connection with the Souter case, it is quite probable that this information may be a complete fabrication, or it may be that Plumlee is purposefully avoiding furnishing accurate information.
So, one way or another, it's fabrication for the purposes of simply making it up, or it's fabrication for the purposes of misdirection.
And this is before the Kennedy assassination.
Right. Go ahead.
Okay. So, in another instance, FBI agents tried to clarify former claims made during an interview with Plumlee, and during the interview, Plumlee cannot recall specific amounts he was paid for his alleged weapons smuggling. Plumlee commented that he was so emotionally involved by his problems with his wife that he hardly knew what he was doing most of the time. He prior implied one Pete Sanchez was a person of interest, yet later he stated in reality he could not attest to the fact that this was the person's true name. He was then asked whether this is the same man he had called Johnny Smith in discussing the case with agents on a previous occasion, and he said that he believed it was. After relating his entire series of claims, Plumlee told FBI agents he was Sure, no one would believe his story in as much as it was rambling, incoherent, and nonspecific, but he insisted what he said was true, although because of his emotional problems and the many things he had on his mind, he was unable to further clarify his story.
So even he himself admits that it's rambling, incoherent, and makes no sense. I mean, that's beautiful. Trish, you got any comments to add to this?
Oh, to be quite honest, I'm learning a lot about this because this is one of those topics that I haven't really touched base on. So I do appreciate Carmen's hard work on this because he's definitely enlightening me with this.
Well, that's great. You know what? I think Carmine is, again, saving you some effort because if you dig into this,
yes.
It goes nowhere.
Yeah.
So, this is why
that's
I love
right.
you, Carmine.
That's why I've never really looked into it.
So, yeah.
Yet,
so,
yeah, go ahead.
Well, we have multiple agents, you know, and I'm not saying that in every instance it can always be relied upon, but when you have enough people saying the same thing over a series of interviews, and even Plumlee is kind of indicting himself in some of these statements, you know, it's, yeah, the credibility, in my opinion, there's some questions, definitely. And then, what I tried to do is I went to the agency's files, because those were some of the FBI stuff. And I wanted to see what agency files, because as we all know, that, you know, even in cases where they try to destroy evidence, there's always something that escapes. Some little bit here or there that can lead you to something that they were working on that they shouldn't have been. Like, you know, for instance, the assassination guide.
Yeah, right.
You know, stuff gets out that they can't hide. So there was one central agency, CIA document stated that as of the HSCA investigation, that the CIA had no file information about Plumlee, and this may imply he never worked for them or the file was compartmentalized. But nothing that the CIA found at that time would indicate that he had prior worked for them, so during the course of when this abort team was supposedly to have occurred.
And let me just say this, that even researchers should know this, because there have been various teams of individuals who have interviewed Plumlee, okay, and I have personally seen one of those uncut interviews where obviously it never made it to the DVD, but the original videotape of it, you know, this is how far back we're going here, the original videotape of it shows that at the end, he makes these statements that are exactly what you said, Carmine, self-indicting, where it's like, well, you know, I don't necessarily say that this makes sense or anything, but, you know, I told you what I could, and, well, you know, I might not have had things straight or whatever. He makes these statements himself all the time. And somehow this guy's out raising money. He raised money for a website recently. I don't know if it was successful. I don't even want to really talk about it to point people at it. But you saw that.
$1,000 website. Yes, I saw that.
Yes, the $200,000 website he wanted to raise money for. And also he wanted to buy a plane too, didn't he? Wasn't that another thing he was trying to?
Sure,
I don't know. I'm getting mixed up here. But the thing is even after he expels all this nonsense, he'll turn around at the very end himself and tell you, well, I know it doesn't make any sense. He does it all the time. It's hysterical. And yet these people pick it up and carry, you know, cut that last part off of the tape and stick it into a DVD presentation, you know, Mr. Dankbar. But, you know, you'll do stuff like that. But realizing that this guy himself is telling you, basically, I don't have a straight story here, you know. I mean, but go ahead, Carmine.
Well, Zach, you were asking me a question.
Yeah, I was going to ask you there, bud. You know, I know you looked at way, way, way more of these CIA documents than myself. Have you ever encountered a document where they actually admitted that somebody was working for them?
As far as people that did work for them, and, yeah, and the internal documents, like the ones that you can see, if you like look in, you know, check in the Office of Security or in the DCD, the Domestic Contacts Division, they'll have internal documents.
Okay.
They do admit that certain people work for them, but it's, you know, it's hit and miss, as you know. You know, it's just basically going through.
But I'm sure, like, that would more than likely not include things like contract agents and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. Anybody, yeah. Well, some form of that's the thing that really struck me as strange, because the next two I can just knock these out as we talk. They're not even – it's just a one-line description. Another, basically, so he wasn't in the main general files. So then I checked the files, and I found an agency's domestic contacts division. They did a search on him, and there was nothing on Plumlee there either. Then the CIA Office of Security did a search. Nothing on him in there either. So – it's possible some file could exist, but I don't think he's anyone of importance, because he would have got a hit somewhere by someone among the HSCA, the Office of Security, the DCD, and checking through the general indices.
Yeah, and at that time, even a person of interest would have generated a personnel file somewhere. There would have been a personnel file. I mean, even these contract guys who had any sort of important jobs, that's not to say that every single contact or source had a file. But at some point, they're mentioned somewhere. And to date, I have not seen anything produced that directly ties Plumlee to the agency, realistically.
Circa 1963, definitely. Yeah.
Circa 1963, absolutely not. You know, and does it mean that it doesn't exist? No. But it does mean that, you know, how deep do we have to go in order to find this guy?
Well, if they're not going to produce it, then I think that doesn't lend any credence to their claims. You have to prove it. We have to give you – that's why we're giving you the evidence links. So you can go and look it up and agree and disagree, but it's right there, and that's what it says. You know, we didn't write it. We're showing it to you.
And I'm gonna put all these links, by the way, into the podcast information tonight. So when it comes out, you know, you guys will be able to look at all this stuff for yourselves. But go ahead, Carmine.
So yeah, so basically, having established no trace of Plumlee there at the time, you know, let's try to look for him in '63. What he was doing in '63. So Palm Beach County authorities had jailed Plumlee for not returning an airplane he rented in May of 1963.
Whoops.
Plumlee claimed to be a pilot at the Houston International Airport and presented this as a reference to the First Citizens National Bank of Houston. He also gave a prior bank reference that was unverifiable. If he had regular access to airplanes via an official group, it's likely he would not be renting planes, and he would definitely not invite attention by abandoning them. This is months before the assassination. This is when people are supposed to be training and getting things ready, and you know, and he's doing this. He's, you know, taking stunts.
Yeah, acting at the behest of the CIA a couple of months before the assassination of Kennedy, claiming that the CIA is connected directly. You would have to imagine that he would have had access to some planes of some sort and not be required to seek to rent them and make agreements and try and put up collateral and, you know, bank accounts and whatever. That it immediately, you know, again, the public record destroys the story. So good.
So June 1963, this next month, he tells Deputy Sheriff Larry Yates he possessed $13,000 hidden in a Miami locker while he was incarcerated. Yates had the locker found and inspected. Officials reported a lone pair of binoculars in the locker. He further asserted CIA agents and Cubans were constantly tracking him in Miami. Plumlee was known to the Miami FBI office as an unreliable chronic complainant. He was noted to make repeated unproven claims to officials and still was in jail June of 1963. He was also wanted in two other jurisdictions for fraud and passing bad checks. In my opinion, it is highly improbable that any plotter would use someone recently jailed repeatedly and someone who contacted officials. Plumlee also subsequently claimed, you know, in his newer statements, that he was part of the CIA's Task Force W, and that's while he's in jail. Really? William Harvey appointed you to Task Force W, and then you went and got busted for not returning a plane, and they were just cool with that? Really? That's the story? Okay.
I'm speechless. I'm speechless there.
It gets better.
Go ahead.
So, subsequently, Plumlee serves another short term of imprisonment in Florida. This is after June. This is just months before the assassination of President Kennedy. In a lengthy statement that allegedly repeated some of his illegal operations and associations with Johnny Roselli and various well-known exiles, Plumlee states he did not see Roselli from 1963 to 1968.
That's a problem.
This legal statement would contradict the entire abort team story, puts him out of contact with Roselli during the year of the assassination, and renders, in my opinion, every claim he makes highly improbable without substantial evidence to support them.
Okay, so now we have absolutely answered the question, because it has been put to me before. Why don't you have Tosh Plumlee on your show? And I immediately stated, well, look, Alex Jones has him on, so what does that tell you? But put that all aside. Now you have the answer as to why I don't bother to talk to Robert Tosh Plumlee. Okay. We are just about out of time, guys. Is there anything quick that we should throw in here, Carmine?
I hope you liked it.
Oh, absolutely.
I had no idea that it was going to go as deep as it did. I thought that there'd be some inconsistencies, but I didn't actually think I'd find a document that has his statement where he says he didn't see Roselli in 1963.
Yeah, it's beautiful, isn't it?
What's kind of crazy is in the same statement, he makes a comment about how he says he did see him, but that's...
Right, and according to his own statements all the time, his stories are incoherent. So thank you for that piece of honesty, Mr. Plumlee, if that is in fact your real name. Okay, so Trish, Zach, you know, either one of you or both of you, would you like to give people a tagline for tonight, something to take away from JFK Assassination Myths 9?
I think the most important thing is just, again, don't close avenues till you've done your research. And, again, you have to go to the primary sources. There's so much research that has been paraphrased by other researchers, and it again, turns into a myth over time. Is it a legend or a myth? And, you know, I think at the end of the day, you have to do your homework and give both sides an equal ring. You have to be able to dig deep and look at everything. And again, you have to be unbiased at it, because if you have your opinion set before you even start researching anything, that's going to hinder what you discover.
Yeah, I'd like to back up what Trish says, and she's absolutely right that it's extremely important to look at the primary source documents, particularly the documents that I know Carmine loves to look at, the FBI and CIA stuff, but the stuff that more than there's the stuff that Trish and I tend to look at, which is the testimonies and other documents, the things that, you know, but the reason is that the stories in them are almost more interesting than what you'll read in a book.
Right.
It's you're getting the meat of the story. And a lot of times it's so fascinating that I just, you know, hope that people realize that and don't just stick to the, secondary information.
You don't need to make stuff up. I mean, the story is interesting enough as it is. Again, it's whether or not you want to put the effort into finding out the truth. And I know it's very cliche to say that, but at the end of the day, that's the truth.
Right. And the truth is, in fact, stranger than fiction, and quite often a whole lot more enlightening than you might imagine. So what we need to do, in my estimation, is separate the reality from the fictions, which many people are still, and as we speak, continuing to generate and germinate out there in, you know, the different corners of the internet, in, you know, with certain publishing companies where it seems like they either, you know, print something really great or something really terrible. Trying to. You know, that's just the way it goes. Carmine, your closing thoughts on JFK Myths 9.
I'm just really happy that we got to have Trish and Zach back, and we need to make sure it isn't this many episodes again until we see each other again.
Absolutely. I actually envision
that sounds great.
And I envision a grand panel, actually, for Myths 10. I mean, perhaps we'll bring Sherry Feaster back on, who's been part of it at one point. We'll bring Rob on. We'll bring everybody on, I think, for Myths 10 and really, really hit some of the nails directly on the head, so to speak, because it's absolutely necessary, I think, that for as long as we engage in the nonsense, for as long as we have to sift through all this stuff, it is time to clear the table, Carmine, as you said. And absolutely, I'm so grateful to all of you guys who have helped me do this, because if I was just doing it myself, it almost sounds like I'm just bashing people, you know, and I'm just after, oh, you're just, you know, upset with somebody else and all that. And you know what? Sometimes I am, but with good reason. And
Nice.
So thank you for giving me some sanity. And of course, always, Carmine, I love the fact that you come loaded for bear with tons of documentation. After all, adherence to the evidence will at least give us firm ground to stand on. And not necessarily that all the evidence is in the official files. Oh, no, 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 no. You'll never hear me make that claim. But it is not a bad starting point when trying to at least draw out a map from which to work regarding this this continuous nexus of, you know, strangeness, not only the real strangeness that's actually behind all these events, but all the manufactured stuff which has been created for various people's agendas, in some cases to enrich themselves, in some cases to ingratiate themselves, in some cases I think because maybe they feel as though they have wasted their lives otherwise, and they take their little brush with history that they may or may not have had and spin it into a greater yarn. Again, look toward the etymology that I described at the very top of this show. So, debunked blog, you know, your website again, you know, where you guys do a lot of your posts, Trish and Zach?
Yeah, it's debunkedblog, one word, .wordpress.com.
Right, a lot of great stuff there about some of the subjects we touched on tonight and many, many more. Absolutely love the work that you guys do, both of you. And, of course, Neapolis Media Group, Carmine Savastano, also the author of Two Princes and a King, which I've featured on this show many times, and not just because Carmine is my friend, but because it was meticulously done. And also Trish and Zach are here, not just because they're friendly, cool people, but they are. You know, the fact is that they're here because they have taken the time and effort to actually dissect all of these events in a responsible fashion, and that's what it is we're after. We want to go after the real evidence. We would like to come to a conclusion at some point very soon. And, hey, wouldn't it be nice to actually get to the truth? So thanks once again, Carmine Savastano, Trish Fleming, and Zachary Gendro. This has been the Ocelli Effect, JFK Assassination Myths, Episode 9. And I hope all you guys enjoy yourselves. Thanks once again, and stay tuned to American Freedom Radio. Who knows what's up next, but I guarantee you it'll be something interesting. Tomorrow night, not sure who's showing up, but future guests are going to get even more interesting. And you know what? You'll hear from these three panelists again when we do JFK Myths 10. So, have a good night, everybody, and I'll see you tomorrow.
News and information you can trust. This is American Freedom Radio. Freedom, freedom, American Freedom Radio. Radio. American Freedom Radio.
Nutritious food is real body armor. It builds muscle, burns fat, improves digestion, and feeds the entire body the nutrients it needs. Did you know the U.S. government banned the hemp plant from growing in the United States and classified it as a Schedule I drug to hide it behind the marijuana plant? People have been confused about this plant for over 80 years, and many still don't know what hemp is. So now you know hemp is not marijuana, and marijuana is not hemp. They are different varieties of the same species. HempUSA.org wants the world to know these basic facts and to help people understand that hemp protein powder is the best-kept health secret you need to know about. Remember, hemp protein powder contains 53% protein, is gluten-free, anti-inflammatory, non-GMO, and is loaded with nutrients. Call 888-910-4367, 888-910-4367, and see what our powder, seeds, and oil can do for you. Only at HempUSA.org.
We all know that they're not telling us the truth. So stand up for your rights, demand the real medicine, and your right to use it and grow it. This is Rick Sensen, and you're listening to American Freedom Radio.
Yo, what's up? Check this out.
The voice of the revolution. American Freedom Radio. American.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the war in the Persian Gulf.
You know my favorite part of that war? It's the first war we ever had that was on every channel plus cable. We like war. We're a warlike people. We like war because we're good at it. You know why we're good at it? Because we get a lot of practice. This country's only 200 years old, and already we've had 10 major wars. We average a major war every 20 years in this country, so we're good at it. And it's a good thing we are. We're not very good at anything else anymore. Huh? Can't build a decent car. Got no steel industry left. Can't educate our young people. Can't get health care to our old people. Now, you probably noticed I don't feel about that war the way we were told we were supposed to feel about that war, the way we were ordered and instructed by the United States government to feel about that war. You see, I tell you, my mind doesn't work that way. I got this real moron thing I do. It's called thinking. And I'm not a very good American because I like to form my own opinions. I don't just roll over when I'm told to. Sad to say, most Americans just roll over on command. Not me. I have certain rules I live by. My first rule, I don't believe anything the government tells me. Nothing. Zero. Nope. And I don't take very seriously the media or the press in this country, who in the case of the Persian Gulf War were nothing more than unpaid employees of the Department of Defense, and who most of the time function as kind of an unofficial public relations agency for the United States government. So I don't listen to them. I don't get all choked up about yellow ribbons and American flags. I consider them to be symbols, and I leave symbols to the symbol-minded.
You're listening to AmericanFreedomRadio.com, the network who perseveres in delivering intelligent debate, constructive dialogue with true independence. The freedom to broadcast the truth is not free at all. So what is American Freedom Radio worth to you? The empowering information with fun, honest and pure integrity behind it provides an example to follow. Friendships to flourish with the moral altruism that pulls no punches. The hosts sacrifice and show remarkable discipline in their duty to deliver quality radio and service to the community with strength, wisdom, and loyalty. The founders of AFR wish to thank you personally for sharing your views and insights to make the best radio and alternative media. Now it's time for you to give something back and play a vital role in the future of America. Be as generous with us as we've been with you. Click on the donate banner at AmericanFreedomRadio.com or volunteer by emailing AmericanFreedomRadio@ymail.com. Vaccines, psychotropic drugs, and artillery batteries not included.
No rules.
No rules.
No taboo topics.
No taboo topics.
No fear of doom.
No fear of doom.
We are
American Freedom Radio.
American Freedom Radio.